I'll try not to bring any age into this next introduction, although this person has suffered with me for at least the last year or so. He is currently under a life sentence on the board of directors of the Big River Association. He was its long-term secretary. He has left that position. I think he's happier now. At least he's more relaxed. And his name is Carter Rivard. Now, what I know of Carter is he lives in St. Louis, but his spiritual home is in Oklahoma on an Indian reservation. I asked him tonight to read some of his Native American poetry. He said to say he doesn't have any books for sale, so don't go looking for them. But he does have poems and collections by Simon Ortiz. He's been published in the Greenfield Review, and he teaches at Washington University in the English Department, medieval literature, linguistics, and Native American literature. And my sources tell me he's the only professor at Washington University that's ever taken students to a Native American dance. Now, he mentioned to me tonight there is a Native American dance on September 26th at St. Anne's Church in Normandy, and if anybody wants to be taken there, you should contact him later. Carter Rivard.
Not all of which I'm going to read, it's just the things I need to pick out are in here. Can you all hear? I hope the sound is out there, okay? The dance will be on the what's called Native American Day. It's Saturday the 26th of September out in St. Anne's Parish Church is where Father De Smet left from to go west and do some missionary work. I'll be gourd dancing as part of that, so you can come and see me look a little different from here. But there's a lot of dancers coming from Wichita and from a lot of other places. This is sort of once a year thing. And so if you're interested, let me know, and I'll try to find a way to see if you can get there. I'm going to read about three shortish things here. And one here. I thought I would try to take us away a little bit from St. Louis. And I thought I would read first one called Letter to Friends on the Isle of Skye, which, as you know, is an island in the Hebrides off Scotland. And I wrote this back in 71, 72, after I'd been over visiting some friends there. This is the letter to the friends from St. Louis after I'd got back. Dear Frankie, Maud, and Joe, I'm sitting here sunk in sloth in St. Louis. And even though last night when I was walking, a yellow blinking light spread gold upon the rain-glazed street ahead of me and behind, its only message was caution. So I keep thinking how on Skye the golden eagles came when Joe and I were standing on a waterfall edge halfway down from the high watershed to the ocean on that side of Skye. And Joe was looking down toward the Atlantic, where the green sides of the veil held like a wine glass that brimming purple Atlantic. And I was watching just below us the brown quick wren bobbing into crevices among great mossy boulders of the pyramid island under the fall where we stood, the wren popping out through heather fringe and sending its silver needle trill through swash and champagne thunder, then pouncing neatly on the pillbugs there in dust and darkness of the crevice, and coming out swallowing with her wings akimbo and stub tail tilting, a black eyebead cocked toward us watching above. And leaning over the fall edge, looking down on the wren's darting business, my senses gurgling with a plastic silver music, a sudden flick of the eye ripped the trilling free from the bird's beak and pinned it down at my foot, at my boot, to a rock, just warbling its wave spray flute in the throat of the waterfall's tuba, and waked in my ears the voices of birds before sunrise streaming here from stones, from ripples, and putting my head up under a granite slab as into a seashell's concert, heard the ringing of mockingbird changes on oboes, mosquitoes, coloraturas, over the cataract's bass viol grumbling upstream, and turning to see that music, instead saw hanging 10 feet over the water a great dark brown bird, his yellow eye watching us and the wren and the twinkling sea, And he rose as I turned. He steered with his spread tail as heavy as a Viking ship turning in the air currents over the stream. He swung and sailed downwind to leftward. But my voice came back and I said, "Turn around, Joe, binoculars." You remember, Joe, how you turned and it scared the piss out of you? So you nearly fell over, seeing that great glaring head down and his grappling talons lowered, even as he swung into the wind and rose again up the cliffside, floated out over the stream, crossing in silence above its flashing noise, and finding an updraft, rose higher, floating up shelf by shelf to the cliff top and over, being joined in the distance by two others soaring high against white clouds and quartering off to hunt down the steep sides of Lorigill, where the red grouse and hares were hiding in bracken. But before they had quite vanished, plunging out from the rock juts beneath their great easy circles, there came two ravens fleeing, voiceless and panicked, flapping across the wide vale with black undulations till, nearing the other cliff tops, they swung smoothly apart like boys on roller skates with a flourish to land among broken rocks, then looked back and croaked defiance of great gold bullies, strutting their elegant blackness and laughter as though just returned from taking back in that wilderness of rocks to the prophet Elijah his daily bread. I thought, since John asked if I would read something Indian, I would read something called Close Encounters. I wrote this back about 78. And I've been asked to, it came out in a magazine called Shanty, and they'd asked me to send some stuff. So I'd been asked to read in New York that winter at an MLA meeting. And we were supposed to come there and read our things and then explain what they were all about. And we were supposed to talk about the other American Indian poets and then explain our own stuff a little bit too. And I wrote about a 19-page thing, not on this, but on some of the other poets, and I found myself trying to explain this thing, which was rather short. And so when I got it out and looked it over to see if this was something that John would be satisfied if I read, I decided he wouldn't, so I revised it. And I thought I'd put into it a little of the stuff that I left out, probably a mistake. This is called Close Encounters. And it goes back to the naming ceremony thing, which I'm so fond of talking about in the Osage ceremonies. I had been given my name, so I felt as though I could talk a bit about it. I think the rest of it will explain itself. It's in two basic parts, one in myth time and one in Las Vegas time. "We have come," so the naming ceremony said, "down from the stars. We sent ahead our messengers to learn how to make our bodies, to make ourselves a people, with power to live, to go on, to move as the sun rises and never fails to cross the sky into the west, to go down in beauty into the night, to join the stars once more, moving infallibly across the skies and rise again at dawn, letting the two great shafts of light beside the sun become white eagle plumes in the hair of children when we name them. When we came down, our messengers were met by friends. They let us take their bodies with which we live into the peaceful days. We met the thunder and the mountain lion, the red bird and the cedar tree, black bear and golden eagle. As eagles we came down, and on the red oak boughs we landed, shaking loose with our weight the showers of acorns, seeds for new oaks, and our daily bread. The leaves were light and dancing. We looked through the trees and saw the sun caught among the leaves dancing around its light. It was the leaves we saw, those light beings who raised as they danced the heavy oak trunks out of earth. They gathered the wind and sunlight, the dew and morning, into timbered lodges for the sun and stars. And so, of course, we sang. Nothing's lighter than leaves, we sang. Ghost dancing on this oak tree, as the Spirit moves. And nothing's heavier than the great sun-warming red oaks, which the dancing in time has raised up from this earth where we came down as eagles. It will not end, we sang. Leaves of paper will in time, we said, be dancing lightly, making a nation of the sun and other stars. Coming down to Las Vegas as a passenger on Frontier Airlines is a myth of another color. There in that trickster city at the Rocky Mountain Modern Language Association, I was to give a paper on trickster tales. I gave it, and I got out solvent, astonished, and all but mythified. I left, I think, in the chariot of Zeus that took us up, up and away over Lake Mead, and I looked down at its ultramarine water and thought back to the many splendored neon and krypton lights of Las Vegas, fed by the Colorado River's power. I thought of all the dead rapids and waterfalls drowned in Lake Mead, thought how those lakes are of such enormous weight, the earth's crust quivers with constant tiny quakes from them, and I saw it was Frankenstein's monster stretched beneath me, his eye, Las Vegas, the lightning pulsing into his eyeball from long copper serpents lifted up on crossbars. And I remembered how among the streaked and painted bluffs that surround Las Vegas, I saw the October dawn come streaked and painted over its eastern skies, and I walked from my travel lodge over the street to a vacant lot under the desert willows, where lived a wren, some vivid orange flowers, papery, on thorn-leaved stems hugging the sand, and one empty billfold with its credit card spread around a sole identity card that pictured a security guard from San Diego, the naval base there. I turned the billfold in to the motel clerk. The wren pleaded innocent and flew away, and when I got the orange flower back to St. Louis and put it in a glass of water, it turned the water to pungent amber and wilted as if I'd killed it with kindness. Frankensteins always carry lost identity cards and desert flowers and find themselves surrounded by dawn. And so I sang how the white sails of Columbus, of Cortez, and the Pilgrims brought this krypton iris here and made the desert bloom, how they raised the great light-sculptured houses of cards and dice on the sand. I sang how the rainbow spirits of drowned waterfalls are pulsed into the sockets of Las Vegas light flashing in crimson, green, gold, and violets its humongous word, vacancy, vacancy, up to the dancing stars. Now, I thought I'd get back to St. Louis. This is the last thing. It's called In the Changing Light. I did this here last week or yesterday sometime. This is about the cicadas. Flooding the trees with song, they brim July, spill over into August, pulsing with hope, cicadas here. One that our white cat brought me lay, legs neatly folded, on clear wings as on a shroud, green and white and fizzing now and then. Yet when I threw its spread wings and zazzed in a wide curve into the sweet gum tree, where presently its dry buzzsaw whined for some significant other to bear life down into dark, dense earth and gnaw at the roots of things, sans eyes, sans wings, sans song, for 17 years or so. As dawn comes and daylight sharpens, deer slip back into the woods. I wonder what a deer, as danger grows too bright, makes of a world whose darker, truer memories of ear and nose must pierce the dazzle of our alien eyes, more surgical at stripping off its cover, masking themselves in downwind silence. I've read somewhere that the claim by computer people that pain cannot be felt until self-consciousness has been achieved, And they had programmed in this level, so they said, of artificial pain. In A.R. Luria's book, The Mind of a Mnemonist, the man infallibly remembered everything, but all perceptions were unlike ours. Things heard, he tasted. Sweet, bitter, salty. They were neon colors. Rough or silken, icy or blood warm. He laid them like eggs aside on streets. His memory walked stolidly along. Walked back to get them when he needed to. Forgot once a word. Had set it carefully beneath a lamp whose bulb was burnt out. Bud opens into marigold. Bird touched by sunlight sings. Mind thinks I am. Yet, as the old man said, coming out into the light, we wall and cry. I wonder how in this starlit galaxy that song is heard.